la forêt est tellement importante pour nous. Alors quand quelqu'un vient donc toucher à ça, ça nous fait mal au cœur. Ça nous fait tellement mal au cœur. Parce que si nous voyons ce que les sociétés forestières ont fait dans les IFA, là où les engrais passent, ils dépassent la forêt. Toutes les plantes et médecines qui sont là, ils déterrent ça, ils tuent ça. Et ça crée problème.
For more on the dangers facing Cameroon's rainforest, we have contacted Samuel Nguipo, an award-winning Cameroonian lawyer. He's the founder of the Center for Environmental Development. Thanks a lot for your time, Sam. Now, the European Union claims to be at the forefront of environmental conservation, yet companies from member states are destroying Cameroon's rainforest. This is clearly a case of double standards. Now, what's your take?
If I look at what is going on in not only in Cameroon, but in the rest of the Congo Basin countries in Central Africa, yes, there is a lot of logging activities going on. There is a lot of forest destruction going on involving companies of totally diverse nature, either logging companies or mining companies, companies involved in agro industries, large construction companies. So this is a very clear trend that destruction is happening, and we see the forest clearly disappearing. We are very much concerned by what we see. And what we also hear is the speeches, the discourse in Europe and in the rest of the world. Everybody claims to be protecting the environment. But what some companies do is totally contrary to what their states are saying. And this is a trend also that we see, we have been witnessing in the past 30 years.
The government of Cameroon has been criticized for failing to take action to protect the country's rainforest. The masses feel they have been abandoned by the government and are now at the mercy of foreign companies destroying the rainforest.
Cameroon still has 40% of its indigenous forest. The government grants licenses for logging in alignment with their forestry policy. Despite this, illegal logging and land grabbing is a constant battle for the community. No major's Baka Pygmy community have a naturally strong commitment to protect their forest.
Why is the Cameroonian government failing to take tangible action to stop these European multinationals from destroying the country's rainforest?
I think that one of the most destructive actions against the forest, besides logging, was putting in the mind of the decision makers in Africa that they can't do it. They can't achieve development without logging. They have forest on their land. They were very lucky to receive this from nature, and they have to log. They have to grant logging rights. And a forest is supposed to be cut and provide income to the state. I think this is a major mistake. It's an assumption that is totally false. But our policies in Central Africa are all built on this assumption. Nobody thinks the forest can generate income without being logged.
It's estimated that nearly 40% of Cameroon is forested. However, the country is rapidly losing this critical natural resource. According to estimates, more than 3 million hectares of Cameroon's forests have been cleared since 1990, an area approximately the size of Belgium.
Now, Mr. Samuel, what is the general state of the rainforest in Cameroon?
We do not have like a yearly or a periodical assessment of what we have in the forest. So it's very difficult to have scientific grounds to really say what is going on. What we see from our visits on the field is that the forest is very clearly disappearing. A major part of the wildlife is also disappearing, and one of the reasons is that logging has opened access to the forest to many people, including poachers, who were able to go as far as possible to have access to wildlife habitats and log in a very huge quantity. So these are the side effects of logging.
Now a very grim outlook there on Cameroon's rainforest, which needs collective action for its protection. The future of our planet is Africa, because the continent's people, biodiversity and habitats are crucial for genetic diversity in face of climate change.
In a bid to meet the ever-growing demand of forest products and resources at international level, such as wood, palm oil, rubber, and other elements harnessed by industrial logging and extensive agriculture, this will only further deplete Africa's biggest carbon sink. What should be done to stop the destruction of the rainforest in Cameroon that is part of the Congo Basin rainforest area that absorbs carbon dioxide that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere?
I think the very first thing that we should do will be to have a meeting bringing together all the stakeholders to assess what has been done in forest management so far, and to learn the lessons that we can get from what we did in the past 20 years, 25 years, and from there to take decisions. Illegal logging is going on, legal logging is not sustainable, the forest is disappearing, and yet nobody says, let's stop and look behind us to see how we were able to perform. And then from there, let's plan the future. This would be done by any person with a little sense of logic to assess what he did. In fact, every single person at the end of the year assesses what happened in his life in the previous year, and on the grounds of the lessons learned, plans the future, right? Why don't we do it as a state, as a region, the Congo Basin? Why don't we do it for such an important resources that we were so blessed to have on our land?
In an effort to preserve the Cameroon rainforest, it's essential to have political will from the government to stop the greed by European multinationals which do not care about the environment. A local here feels corruption by the authorities is a major factor.
Now, are you optimistic that governments and international community will take action to save and preserve Cameroon's rainforest and indeed Africa's rainforest?
I think if we don't act very fast and if we don't act with very clear actions, efficient enough to change the trend that we are seeing, I think it will be too late very soon. I think the window that we have to act is probably closing very, very soon. So what we need to do today is an action on both, at both ends. We need to act in the consumer countries so that people understand that what they do by buying timber, by consuming timber products, if they are not careful enough, what they do is that they are contributing to the exacerbation of climate change. And we need to act at the producers' end by making sure that the states understand that the forest is on their land, but that they are part of humanity, and as such they are obliged to think about not only their country or their communities but also humanity.
Well, clearly action has to be taken now to save Cameroon's rainforest, or it will be too late and the whole world will suffer the consequences. Well, that's all the time we had for this edition of Africa Today. Do drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's program. God bless you.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Despite Washington's decision not to deploy Marines to Haiti after the July assassination of Haitian President Moi, the devastation of the recent 7.2 earthquake has provided U.S. leaders the cloak of humanitarian aid for doing just that. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Patrick McFarlane, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Deploys Marines to Haiti under guise of disaster relief. Stay tuned for more. Despite Washington's decision not to deploy Marines to Haiti after the July assassination of Haitian President Moi, the devastation of recent 7.2 earthquake has provided U.S. leaders the cloak of humanitarian aid for doing just that. In an effort re-established under the 2010 earthquake response moniker Joint Task Force Haiti, a detachment of roughly 200 Marines departed Camp Lejeune, North Carolina for Haiti recently. The detachment is supported by 420 sailors and several ships and aircraft from U.S. Navy and Coast Guard. The Marines' mission is to provide security for Joint Task Force Haiti, who will work to help find the stranded survivors from the disaster, deliver medical supplies, and provide direct medical assistance, unquote. The Marines will join other U.S. forces already deployed to Haiti, which include U.S. Navy P-8 Poseidon aircraft, a 14-person situational awareness team from Special Operations Command South, stationed at the U.S. Embassy, and the USNS Burlington, a fast transport vessel. Also deployed are 8 helicopters, 3 UH-60 Black Hawks, 3 CH-47 Chinooks, and 2 HH-60 Pave Hawks from Joint Task Force Bravo in Honduras to provide medical air support. 4 of those helicopters have been tasked with moving a surgical hospital to Las Cayes per request of USAID. Other forces include USS Arlington, an amphibious transport dock equipped with a surgical team and landing craft capabilities, and a number of Coast Guard assets, including 3 H-60 Jayhawk helicopters and several cutters. And yes, these forces will be equipped with plenty of COVID-19 vaccines for Haiti, a country which until Moi's assassination remained largely free of the global North COVID response. According to officials, U.S. forces are prepared to remain in Haiti for up to 4 months or more as needed. These efforts follow a pre-earthquake deployment of agents and personnel from the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, both ostensible domestic policing agencies, to aid Haitian officials in the investigation of Moa's assassination. While the humanitarian goal of aiding Haiti in the wake of human catastrophe is laudable, humanitarian efforts in Haiti have a disastrous past. Indeed, Haitians are correct to identify the conceit of humanitarian assistance from a nation that has invaded, occupied, and meddled in that country for over a century to calamitous effect. Haiti is a graveyard of failed NGO projects. Perhaps no better a symbol of crumbling Haitian sovereignty is the National Palace, which since 2010 earthquake has still not been rebuilt. Surely the individual soldiers involved in these deployments act with benevolence in their hearts. Their individual work is providing and conducting direct medical care, aid and rescue, and reconstruction efforts ranks among the very best things the U.S. military does. Even so, this effort comes with the caveat that it is funded at the voluntary and inflationary expense of U.S. taxpayers, a country that is nearly $30 trillion in debt. The unfortunate combined effect of these efforts will be to sink Haiti even deeper into U.S. control and exploitation. To demonstrate this point, one must look at the orchestrators of the latest U.S. relief efforts. They are the very same forces that pillaged that country in the aftermath of 2010 earthquake. Indeed, the newest iteration of Joint Task Force Haiti is led by USAID, a traditional front of the CIA that is used as a vehicle for regime change operations across the world. USAID was created in 1961 to help the United States win the hearts and minds of citizens in poor countries through civic action, economic aid, and humanitarian assistance. As a Cold War policy tool, the agency was at times used as a front for CIA operations and operatives. Among the most infamous examples was the Office of Public Safety, a USA training program in the Southern Cone that also trained torturers. It is when USAID undertakes discreet regime change operations that it runs into trouble. Indeed, its offices of transition initiatives now seems to be competing with, or at least complementing, the CIA on high-tech propaganda and destabilization programs in Cuba, if not elsewhere as well. USAID involvement in Haiti dates back to at least early 1990s, after populist candidate Jean-Bertrand Aristide became the first democratically elected leader of that country in 1991, USAID, the National Endowment for Democracy, NED, and the American Institute for Free Labor Development, that is, AFLED, began pouring money into the country in an effort that was specifically designed to fund those sectors of the Haitian political spectrum where opposition to Aristide government could be encouraged. Soon after, in 1991, Aristide was overthrown by the U.S. in a coup d'etat. He would later tell two U.S. congressmen that he was kidnapped by U.S. troops after being told to leave the country to avoid bloodshed. In the wake of 2010 earthquake, much of the work of coordinating the foreign recovery effort fell to Cherry Mills, the head of the Clinton State Department's Haiti Task Force, and to Rajiv Shah, the then newly appointed head of USAID, neither of which had any disaster response experience. The result was dysfunction like nothing else reconstruction officials had ever seen. USAID was utterly incapable of coordinating foreign aid groups with local and national Haitian government who were either incompetent, corrupt, or completely overwhelmed. Reconstruction efforts lacked any clear strategy. The action plan, while laying out the core priorities for Haiti's recovery, didn't go into many specifics. That left Haiti's ministries to devise their own plans. And 5 years and $13.5 billion later, $1.5 billion direct from USAID and Haiti had cleared rubble from the streets, but had not accomplished much else. Adding insult to injury, the country was now suffering from a cholera outbreak caused by occupying UN military forces. Cholera is a disease that is effectively prevented with clean drinking water, something recovery groups were clearly unable to provide. USAID and other foreign recovery officials were quick to place the blame on the Haitian people and the Haitian government.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why is the uprising of Ashura different from all the uprisings and movements of the world? January 16, 1994. Imam Hussein says, I did not rise up out of self-interest or for the sake of seeking pleasure. The more selfless one is, the more value does he gain in what he does. The more one moves away from the peak of selflessness, the closer they get to the peak of selfishness. This applies to what is tangible, but when it comes to spirituality, these equations are far more discerning. We do not understand it because of our materialistic and ordinary vision. Nonetheless, men of vision understand and perceive it. The critique in this matter, the goldsmith and the jeweler, is God the Almighty. And for sure, the critic sees well. If there is an ounce of impurity in our work, its value would diminish accordingly, and God would reduce its lasting effect. God, the Exalted, is an insightful critic. The work of Imam Hussein is a work in which there is not even a slight hint of impurity. Hence, you see this quality achievement has lasted to this day and will last forever.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana latshan, ana
Who could believe that after these people were killed in that desert, far from their homes, while their bodies were buried there, with so much propaganda spread against them, all killed in such a heartless manner, their hometown of Medina put on fire even after their martyrdom? This rose garden was devastated and the petal of roses were all thrusted. Yet later, anyone who would feel the aroma of the rose water from his garden, according to which rule of nature, a petal of that rose garden can last so long in the nature. However, you view the more time passes by, the more the aroma of that rose garden spreads. There are some people who do not believe that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is the grandfather of Imam Hussein and that he follows in his path. Yet, they believe in Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. Some do not believe in his father, Ali, alayhi salam. Yet, they believe in Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. They do not believe in God, the God Imam Hussein worshipped. Yet, before Imam Hussein, they are humble and respectful. This is the outgrowth of Imam Hussein's purity.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Taliban are preparing to unveil a new government after taking almost full control of the war-torn Afghanistan. The Taliban have pledged to form an inclusive government and respect human rights and women's freedom within their version of the Islamic law. Taliban sources say the group's co-founder and head of political office, Mullah Barodar, will lead the new government in Afghanistan. The EU foreign policy chief says a bloc will engage with the Taliban in order to support the Afghan people, but it does not mean it will recognize a new government there. The United Nations has resumed its humanitarian flights to northern and southern Afghanistan, enabling scores of humanitarian organizations to continue life-saving activities there. The U.S. also pulled out its remaining troops before the end of August deadline, ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. Joining us now from the Afghan capital, Kabul, is our correspondent, Amin Alimi, with all the latest developments in Afghanistan. Amin.
Well, Badia, a blame game is underway in Afghanistan, particularly here in the Afghan capital, on the issue of Panjshir. Taliban sources, mainly its field commanders, say that we have successfully captured the entire Panjshir province in northeastern part of Afghanistan. But in the meantime, Ahmed Massoud, as well as Amrullah Saleh, who are leading the resistance front in northern Panjshir province of Afghanistan, have also released separate message saying that, insisting that we are inside Panjshir and that we have not left this key area and that we are going to resist against the Taliban until we gain victory against these troops. According to Amrullah Saleh, as well as according to a tweet by Ahmed Massoud, who is the leader of Northern Resistance Front. A propaganda has been launched by the enemy of the National Resistance Front in order to gain more morale for the defeated fighters around Panjshir province. This comes as the Taliban earlier had said that we are in full control of Panjshir. In the meantime, some top political leaders, mainly Abdullah Abdullah, former chief of Afghanistan's High Reconciliation Council, as well as Hamid Karzai, the former Afghan president, are doing their best here in Kabul to convince both sides in order to approve a ceasefire that will that should lead both sides to resume negotiations in order to reach a peaceful agreement.
All right, thanks a lot, Amin Alami, joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. We're joining us on tonight's Spotlight. We have writer and blogger, social activist and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Mr. Sayed Muaz Shah, joining us from Karachi. Also, we have journalist and political analyst Shahid Qureshi, who's joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Muaz Shah in Karachi. As we know, the Taliban are set to announce a new government soon. What are your expectations, having in mind the promises that they've made about being an inclusive government?
I think this is an interesting place to start because, you know, as you know, the news was that today we were going to get some sort of insight to that. But I think the activities and recent events in Panjshir Valley have kind of stalled that announcement. But as you stated earlier, there are sources, variable sources, that have reported that Mullah Brother would be the head of this new government. Along with that, there's some indication of the former leadership, including Mullah Yaqub, who may come in a second tier of leadership as well. But when I think about the inclusive nature of the government, I think there was some discussion, obviously, that's been going on from the beginning with Hamid Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah. And there was a source that recently disclosed that, you know, with Hamid Karzai, he, you know, in quote unquote, is an old horse, and that they were probably not going to engage him in an official capacity. That is yet to be seen. But that Abdullah is someone that they would probably most likely engage in some sort of discussion. And we see that clearly indeed, as you indicated, that they are the mid-go-level people negotiating between the Panjshir Valley resistance and the Taliban. So the Taliban have some sort of trust that they're able to come out with a negotiated solution. As you know, that they have been negotiating with the Panjshir Valley elders for quite some time, for weeks in fact, even before the Americans left. And there was a movement to that. But there was a lot of discussion. Some of the discussion that came to fore that was recently reported was that one of the negotiating elements was that the Panjshir Valley resistance was requesting somewhere around 30% of the ministerial seats, which was something that the Taliban just would not accept. And that's why we're seeing what we see. And if you even watched Amanullah Saleh's own tweet and Twitter account before today's tweet, he recently actually tweeted about how the Taliban had cut the electricity and the internet connection. And in fact, if you actually observe very carefully in Amanullah Saleh's video that recently that you were referring to, that they're still there, you can hear the humming of a diesel generator in the background. So it's quite possible that they're still there, but I think one of the key things is that there has been significant change in the Panjshir Valley. We'll find tomorrow morning what the situation is. It may not have entirely fallen, but Taliban most likely, through all the sources, do indicate they have made significant gains there.
All right, Mr. Qureshi in London, what about pledges by countries to engage with the Taliban? There's Russia, there's China, there are other countries in the region. The British Foreign Secretary says there's a need to engage with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The EU foreign policy chief says a bloc will engage with the Taliban, but it doesn't mean it will recognize a new government there. What will be the extent and nature of these relationships, in your opinion?
Well, thank you. It's a good question. What I believe is that what are the challenges the current victors of the current war against the occupying forces of colonialists who were occupying Afghanistan for the last 20 years. The challenge is that they have activated their tools like IMF, World Bank. They've frozen their assets to make this government to fail. So what needs to happen is the neighboring countries, which you just mentioned, including Pakistan and Iran, for example, Uzbekistan and Russia and China, they should come forward and make sure there's no shortage of food supplies to the people of Afghanistan, because they have been suffering for the last 20 years of these great game. With regards to the international pledges, I mean, they are the losers who are making all these pledges. And as I said before, the tiger won't lose his sleep over the opinion of a sheep. These people have fought with nothing, and they won the war. The war cost to those people who are making pledges $3 trillion, 5,000 or 20,000 injured. So the question is whether does it really matter to the people who are in power at the moment? The answer is no, it doesn't. But as a matter of legitimacy, and I think it's a good time that the people or the countries should define what does it mean to be called international community. I mean, 3-4 countries who get together and calling themselves international community. That's not. We have more than 200 countries in the world. So when we should use the word international community, that's also a very important question. With regards to Amirullah Saleh and Ahmed Massoud, I think in any ideal situation, these people should be put on trial for war crimes and collaborating with the invaders and occupiers. They are traitors. These people have committed crimes against humanity, against their own people. They were collaborating people who were killing civilians and vettings in drone attacks. This guy, they're calling some resistance forces. They're thieves. They're responsible for stealing the money of the state. As we have seen, the president of with whom Amirullah Saleh has been and Ahmed Massoud have been enjoying the support of those occupiers.
Sure.
For the last 20 years. They have no right to come forward and they call themselves resistance. They are criminals, basically. They should be put on trial. In any ideal situation, the people who should be put on trial is the Dostum, who was responsible for killing its own people. They were Afghans. It's irrelevant if they were Taliban or whatever faction they belong to. But the way the Dostum treated, and these people, Amirullah Saleh especially, he's an Indian stooge, basically. He's a spoiler. He's an ungrateful man who's been accusing Pakistan for a long time. He's an ungrateful man who was blaming Pakistan, who's hosting 3 million of his countrymen for the last 40 years. These people are...
Let's bring in Mr. Moaz Shah back into the discussion. Sorry to interrupt you there. Mr. Moaz Shah, what about the extent and nature of a U.S.-Taliban relationship? That, too, is one of the key issues that needs to be worked out. Like, for example, the U.S. Treasury Department, it says restrictions on Taliban access to the international financial system remains in place. Do you think that's being used as some form of leverage at this point?
Oh, I think definitely it's a political leverage and very relevant. In fact, I think it's almost suicide for Joe Biden to kind of even take a soft, even a little angle. Right now, his approval ratings are the worst he's ever witnessed in his presidency. So they're going to tread very carefully on that $9 billion that they have in Afghanistan government's money and to release that. And I think that's going to be attached with possibly commitments certain action items that the Taliban government, I think everybody is waiting really when the Taliban government will be announced officially. And one thing I just wanted to add from Pakistan's side, today's Shah Mahmood Qureshi, the foreign minister, said that we will recognize a Afghanistan government that represents the Afghanistani people. And our commitment is to the people of Afghanistan. So if, again, going to what the previous speaker mentioned about how the country has come in support of the Taliban in a more broader framework than the existing Kabul regime, I think that's going to play out, and that may, you know, we may see the recognition, particularly as you noticed just earlier this week, the Chinese were considered the best friends for the Taliban, and they and the Russians didn't close down their embassies. So there are indications that are very clear. Pakistan also has, you know, the border points at some levels open for humanitarian reasons, and I think we will see probably the regional players in Asia. From the Chinese and the Russians primarily first, and then followed by Pakistan, and I believe Iran as well, will recognize this government. And I think the Taliban are open to this inclusion of elements of the previous regime and government, but those who have clean hands. And as the previous speaker said, unfortunately, a lot of the leadership and people who are in power have records of corruption. If you even remember Abdul Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah, were live loggerheads in the previous election, and they had to kind of come to an agreement because of, you know, many accusations. And so I think that we will see Abdullah Abdullah definitely play a significant role, along with some other leaders, as well as we see the Taliban have been more inclusive. In fact, the very commander who is leading the Taliban effort in the Panjshir Valley is a Tajik. And so Taliban have become sensitive to including within their framework other ethnicities, including the Hazara minority. And I think this time the Taliban have a wider mandate that comes with support from all sections of society. And that's because, right, unfortunately, the hearts and minds were not won by the U.S. occupational forces of the Kabul regime. And Taliban, in turn, in my opinion, in the past 20 years, have inherently won the hearts and minds.
Talking about hearts and minds, Mr. Qureshi, in London, American intelligence assessments, they claim they didn't foresee such a rapid collapse of the Afghan military. British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab said Britain's intelligence assessment was that it was unlikely Kabul would fall this year. Why did the Taliban sweep across the country much more quickly than expected?
Well, I think this is the second failure of the U.S. Intelligence and U.S. security system in the last 20 years. They failed on the 9/11. The 15 intelligence agencies, including the U.S. Air Force, completely failed on the day of the 9/11, and they failed to stop those terrorists committing atrocities against the civilians. And then after 20 years spending $3 trillion, they failed again. And that shows this war was not a war. It was more of a scandal of the war military industrial complex, where they found a spot where they can create a conflict, and then they were selling or they were sending military equipment which was not needed in that type of war. In guerrilla warfare, you don't need tanks and Humvees and all these equipments. They send it to Afghanistan. But they were, because they were producing those, and the shareholders were getting rich. And I think it is, I must appreciate President Biden, although people are criticizing him, to take this brave step, because in damage control, you do not wait for the right time. You just stop where you are, and then you move back and step back. And I think the President Biden has, and also President Trump, made the right decision. They did introspection, because the U.S. infrastructure itself, the roads, the bridges, their own infrastructure is in need, and they need about $2 trillion, because in the last 50 years, they haven't spent enough money on that. With regards to the failure of the intelligence, that shows that the two countries who live in the movies, that is India, who live in Bollywood, and then the Americans who live in Hollywood. So their heroes are these Rambos, and so on the ground, the failure of intelligence, it shows they were relying too much on the electronic gadgetry than having a proper on the ground, on the field, a kind of intelligence and proper assessment.
Okay.
Falling of Afghanistan, in falling of Kabul in 36 hours, which they said is going to be taking 6 months, is a complete failure. In any kind of situation, the boss will sack all those people who were sending those false reports, false assessments back home. And I think in any kind of business model, if you have these kind of employees who are not performing, who spend too much money, and the money disappeared into offshore safe havens, in banks, and the Wall Street is obviously responsible for all this death and destruction and war profiteering, as well as the, I must say that this the Western media especially keep on talking about the rights of the women and the rights of the children. I don't know why they don't talk about the rights of women in Palestine, why they don't talk about the rights of women and children in Kashmir.
Very good point
indeed.
They're
selective in that way.
Mr. Marshall, when Joe Biden, he took over the White House, he claimed that the U.S. is once again a reliable partner. He also boasted that, quote-unquote, America is back. But the U.S. decided to leave Afghanistan without much warning or any consultation with its allies. What does the disastrous fallout in Afghanistan say about Joe Biden's claims?
I think, again, it's PR. It's a PR effort by Biden to try to salvage the situation. Of course, he's kind of playing off what Trump making America great again. So he is trying to do that. But unfortunately, this is not going to go down well. It is an international embarrassment that will go down in the history of man. As the Taliban, again, you know, you may have the watches, we have the time. And clearly, they have demonstrated that throughout the centuries. From stopping the British early on, and then the Russians, and now the Americans. It's only a repeated cycle that even Biden admitted in his press conference in July that this is a graveyard of nations, and I'm not going to, you know, allow the United States to join that. But unfortunately, that was 20 years too late. So I think one of the things that Biden is attempting to do, which unfortunately is not going to be very successful, it's just a sad reality, even though it may have been the right decision, as the fellow speaker was mentioning, it is a costly one politically, because there is no win for Biden here. I mean, there's a loss, and the money that we're talking about, $2 trillion and counting, most of it was spent on the military hardware. More than half of that money was spent on the American military machine, over $1 trillion was just on that. And we're talking about equipment for just the Americans, not the Afghan army or any of them. And if you look at the development funds, I think there's some numbers indicate that only $4 billion. So all these things about women's rights and this focus area was never a focus. And if anybody can open just a cursory review of where the $2 trillion were spent, if you spent even like twice as much that they currently spent, Afghanistan might have rapidly even developed further. But their focus was not that. As President Truman said many years ago, to be careful of and Eisenhower during their time, that we should be careful of this military-industrial complex. Unfortunately, it has come to haunt America again and again with their adventures. And again, that's filling the pocketbooks of certain people. And again, if you know, I just ask the viewers and whoever's listening, just go and examine where those $2 trillion actually went. And just a minuscule amount went to development for the Afghan people. So I think Joe Biden, it's a PR stunt. It's not going to work because the Republicans are hounding. You see Trump, all of a sudden now he's coming out into making comments and speeches. Before he was very silent, and we might even see Trump come back into the White House as a result of this. So we'll see how this plays out. But I think that Biden is in a tough pickle, and I don't think there's a win situation for him either, let alone the Afghanistan debacle.
Shahid Qureshi, President Biden, he forcefully rejected criticism of his decision to end America's 20-year war in Afghanistan, and he declared the end of an era in which the United States uses military power to remake other countries, in his own words. The end of an era, it ended on a very low note, if the end of an era was Afghanistan. Do you think Washington has learned its lesson here?
Well, I think it's a good question. If you don't learn the lesson, you will have the same results what you have. With the situation the United States is finding itself in is will be the same if they do the same thing elsewhere. So what needs to happen here is, and I think it's very hypocritical, we're not going to recognize the Taliban government. You've been negotiating with them in Qatar by bypassing the legitimate, so-called legitimate government of Ashraf Ghani for more than 2 years. So where was your that we don't deal with terrorists, we don't talk to them? You have been talking to them. You signed an agreement with them to the very people you call terrorists. So that's one point. The other point is, I think we shouldn't put too much into the PR what President Biden is doing. Everybody knows what the reality is, and the U.S. public, and especially the U.S. media, is totally a war media. It's run by the Wall Street, as President Trump has suggested a few times, and that was one of the reasons President Trump was thrown out, because the establishment there was most of its security. If they looked at the internal problem U.S. was facing, how many homeless people they have, how many bank and financial scandals the United States has, they wouldn't be in this problem. But the problem is, in the last 50 years, I see that they have been distracting the internal problems, and they have been creating all these. For example, they spent about $6 trillion, I was hearing, somewhere in Iraq. Iraq has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or any kind of terrorism. And the same is in Syria and in Yemen. So they are having these good terrorists and bad terrorists. It sounds like a same script, and they are repeating over and over again. But the real cost which people paid are the U.S. veteran. And I must admit that a soldier is a soldier, no matter which country they belong to. And those soldiers who were fighting this war in the name of defending the country, but in actual fact they were defending the corrupt regime of capitalists or those financial mafia which is running the United States military-industrial complex, which moved all the manufacturing industry to China and somewhere else. And they have they are a consumer society at the moment. There's no hardware manufacturing available in the United States. If United States was a person, nobody will give you £1 as a loan, because the U.S. debt has crossed that ceiling many times.
Okay.
U.S. deficit is gone too high. And these are the things which media or U.S. media and international media is not talking about. It. Taliban don't care who recognize them or who don't. What really matter is the people who are living in that region. And by taking these kind of action, the United States is further alienating itself from that region.
Okay, I'm going to have to jump in there, Mr. Wadeshi. Apologies. We are fresh